So thank you. So when I was thinking about this meeting, I was wondering why I work on NK cells and not T cells with all these questions, and I suppose it's really where as Singh said, where we all came from is that, you know, I started as a clinician, and I was driven by trying to understand preeclampsia, and not as an immunologist trying to go over the Medawar question. And I think you then come to a different place if you do that. I just put up this quotation that Francesco didn't have from Janeway, because I think this was another reason that I didn't study T cells, because it's so difficult to work out when it goes wrong. And in fact, I personally don't think that there is any evidence in humans that aberration of T cell function causes any clinical problems. There's just not any evidence. I'm not saying that it doesn't, but at the moment the evidence isn't there. And as we've heard, there just isn't evidence that there are T cells with T cell receptors that can bind specifically to trophoblasts. So that is still a hugely that they aren't there, but we just don't know still. So if you're going to study preeclampsia, of course, then as we've seen, you get back to studying implantation and placentation if you want to know about the primary defect. So this is really another version of what Chris has shown you, so I won't dwell on this. So the primary pathogenesis is clearly a disorder of placentation. And when you get to placentation, then you're looking here, you're looking in this box. So we're not looking systemically, we're looking in the uterus. And this is where, you know, I was thinking, well, who has the most parallels is what I'm doing? And it's actually the invertebrates, because what is happening here is that there is a definition of a boundary between two genetically different individuals. There's a territorial demarcation, and that this can sometimes favor the mother and sometimes favor the baby. And in normal pregnancies, it's okay. And really the words rejection, tolerance, aren't really very helpful to me in this thinking about this definition of this boundary, which is why I'm not gonna use them. And so what's happening at this boundary is that as we all know, if it doesn't work properly, then you end up with the fetus being starved and the subsequent preeclampsia. But we also know that if the decidua is missing, then the placenta goes straight through. So we know the regulation of this is by the mucosal lining, where the NK cells, of course, are here. So that's really how that we got to this question of saying, if you're looking at what defines the boundary, what are the immune cells that are there? And they are abundantly the majority, which is what Judith showed, and Ankor in the mouse, the abundant NK cells there were NK cells. And of course, at that time, as Francesco said, it became clear that NK cells were mediating hybrid resistance, this odd paradoxical form of allo recognition in mice. So we knew that there was that NK cells could do allo recognition. How they did it was a question. So this really is why we've been pursuing this interaction between these NK cells here, which they clearly do form synapses with these enormous fusing. These are fusing trophoblast cells quite far down in the uterus where they become multinucleate. And of course, we do have actually a molecular interaction for how this works, unlike T cells. We have receptors on these cells, the KIA, that recognize HLA-C. I mean, we have a whole load of other receptors that bind things on trophoblasts, but this interaction is particularly interesting because they're both polymorphic, whereas the others are not. So in this scenario, this is a simple scenario that we'll just look at, is that we've said the mother is C11 here. That's green, sorry, it doesn't say that, but C11. Mm-hmm. And if you just introduce a allogeneic C2, HLA-C2, from the baby, and then if the mother has only inhibitory KIA here, or she has an activating KIA, so this is the same trophoblast, but two different mothers, then the idea is that this will actually give you much better secretion of chemokines and cytokines, which actually help move this boundary into a more favorable position. So it's all about balance. It's really a balancing act of this. And, of course, when we're looking at the KIR, so I don't have to go on this because John's shown this, but these clearly these two separate haplotypes, A and B, which we see in all populations. And when we're thinking of HLA-C, then there's only really these ones that actually are important, these inhibitory ones and the blue activating ones. And this one is usually deleted. And if we're thinking of C2, then really we only have this one on the telomeric end of the B haplotype and 2DL1 on the A haplotype. But just point out that 2DL1, this inhibitory receptor for C2, can also be on the B haplotype sometimes. Not always, but it is sometimes. So now this really was driven by Sue Hebe, and I'm very sorry she's not here really, because she should have sent this, but she's been ill. And so she has now looked in a lot of cohorts, and I think the message is finally becoming clearer. So whatever cohorts we look at with failed placentation, these are controls, fetal growth restriction, recurrent miscarriage, recurrent miscarriage or preeclampsia, the AA frequency is increased compared with controls here. And again, now with a lot of pregnancies, nearly 1,000 pregnancies with preeclampsia collected from around the UK with the help of people like Chris Redman, we can see that this risk, this increase in the AA is only when you see C2 inherited, mainly from the father. So as Richard said, we're not sure whether this is really because it's an allogeneic C2 or whether it's due to the relative dosage between the mother and the baby. And that's obviously we need to sort that out. So that is, and that I think we haven't changed our views by adding in more patients. That just looks more significant now. So here we also have shown that the protective gene is, as you would predict, the activating KIR for C2, 2DS1. And as Richard shows, this now is regulating birth weight, but if you go down to the bottom end of these preeclamptic pregnancies, lacking C2, only 33% of women have it compared with 45% of women. So that's really a reflection of them having the AA genotype, which lacks C2DS1. But I should just point out that although 2DS1 is good, because it prevents you from getting preeclampsia, it can be too good. And this actually, these very big babies, this is birth weight now here, going from 2,000 to 5,000 grams. And what we see is actually that in this very large babies, we have actually an excess of women who've got 2DS1. So it can be too good to have it. Again, this balance is absolutely clear. What does 2DS1 do when it binds, when an NK cell has 2DS1, binds a C2 positive cell? And this, Andrew's work, where we have looked at the expression. Now, we can divide these NK cells up into 2DL1 single positive, 2DL1 double positive, and 2DL1 single positive, and these are all negative. And we can see that the expression of 2DS1 is actually pretty high on decidual NK cells, you know, from 20 to 60%. And it's increased compared with expression, compared with blood. And that is also true for 2DL1. So the expression of these KIR that are binding to HLA-C is much increased in frequency in the uterus compared with the blood. The recognition is skewed towards recognizing HLA-C in these NK cells. It's clearly an important interaction. And Andrew's also now shown that if you actually co-culture these cells and look at these different subsets with C2 target cells, you do indeed, it is indeed functional, you get degranulation. And we then did a microarray of those four different subsets. And came up with various chemokines and cytokines, and really just showing you GM-CSF of proof of principle that when you look at 2DS1 subsets, you see GM-CSF is produced. That's in co-culture with a target cell. And if you ligate with an antibody, you see in the supernatant, in women who have 2DS1, you get increased GM-CSF. And tomorrow, I think, probably you had a huge range. Maybe if you just separated yours into those women who've got AA and those who haven't.
I did.
You did? Oh. So that's not the answer. Okay. So that's just a way that this might work, but obviously that's still a long way to go looking at translating this genetics into a function. And one of the big hurdles in this field, for those of you not in the field, is that there are no trophoblast human trophoblast stem cell lines. So we don't really have very good tools to look at trophoblast function in vitro. So now, some John said, Kier genes are polymorphic at two levels. The A haplotype, we have lots of allelic variation at individual loci. And the B haplotype, we've got this extraordinary variation in number of genes that you can have and this in a B haplotype. So in the UK, the AA frequency is about 27%. And if you combine that with C2, a woman who has a C2, that's 10% of women. So clearly not 10% of women are getting preeclampsia, although it's about 5% actually. But we sort of asked, are there alleles of this risk gene, 2DL1, the risky gene, that are particularly causing risk? So can you actually, in the future then, subdivide these women down to allelic level of their risky gene, 2DL1. And this is a Lamps work who's here. There are, in fact, from Peter's work, 25 proteins from 2DL1. But in Europeans, there's only 4 common ones. So much of this variability is in Africans. So this is the general frequency in our control population here, and these are the 4 common ones. I should say that this one, 004, is on the B haplotype. So the ones that are on the B haplotype actually are different. They function differently. And what we can now see in the preeclamptics here and recurrent miscarriage is that there's just one allele that seems to can be most risky, which is 003. And I think, Peter, am I right? This is the strongest binder, 003, yeah, 2, so which fits with it's giving the strongest inhibition, and that is the strongest risk. So that is now significant. So in this way, I think we will in the future be able to pinpoint women much more accurately who are likely to be at risk. Now, so let me just now come to another project. This is also unpublished, which is in Africa. Now, this is a really shocking slide, in a way, is to see these incredibly high maternal mortality rates in sub-Saharan Africa compared with anywhere else in the world. And about a quarter to a third of these deaths are due to preeclampsia. So I was approached, actually. She found me, actually, by Google. She put into Google preeclampsia in Cambridge, and then wrote to me. This is an obstetrician from Uganda who was extremely worried, you know, because she said, this can't be right, you know, that these women are. And she managed to get money from the Wellcome Trust to do a PhD, and she collected, extraordinary how she managed to do this in the conditions that she's working under, 250 preeclamptic and 500 controlled pregnancies, first pregnancies. And these are incredibly well done because she's an obstetrician and she cared about it. So actually, I think this is rather better than our UK cohorts in some ways. And she also, first thing she asked me actually when she came, she's just published this paper in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynaecology. She said, is preeclampsia commoner in Africans? And I said, I don't know. Is it just that that is it really commoner? And actually, she's looked very hard now in the literature, and preeclampsia is certainly two or three times more common in Africans, independent of socioeconomic circumstances and parts of the world they are. So in London, it's true as well. But there are other very interesting biological differences, such as the gestational age in women of African ancestry is only 38 weeks compared with 40. So there are quite a few other things which are in this review. So she therefore did this study, but one of the things that became obvious, not just from her study, but from other people, is that C2 frequencies in Africa are far higher than anywhere else in the world, so that they're as you see this out of Africa migration, this is native Australians here, you see that you lose the C2 frequencies and you start seeing higher C1. So in the Far East, C2 is very low in frequency. So there's at least one reason why these pregnancies might be more at risk. But when they've done exactly the same analysis, and I promise you that this is the Ugandan cohort, but it looks identical, is that we see this increase in AA frequency, but this is only when the baby is C2. But of course, there's rather few babies because of that very high frequency of C2 in Africa that are C1 homozygous. So this is a little bit of a problem because we haven't got very numbers here still. But it is clearly significant. Now, that's very reassuring, I think, to see exactly the same risk association in such an utterly different population. And just show you that, so that is the UK cohorts, and this is the Ugandans. But she did collect, and we haven't got this from Europeans at all, 25 women who had recurrent preeclampsia. And they're not enough to do anything clever with them, but I just thought it's worth putting, that's the AA frequency, and that's their association with C2. There was only one pregnancy that didn't have that combination, actually. So I think that focusing on recurrent preeclampsia would be very, very valuable, actually, to dissect out the genetics further. Now, of course, what's the protective gene is interesting, and I hope Peter's going to show this, but we've shown in Europeans that 2DS1 is the protective gene, but Paul Norman in Peter's lab has actually shown that this telomeric B region is very, very low frequency in Africans, and you're going to talk about that, so I won't talk about it. It's very low. It's very low frequency in Africans, and whether it was never there, and it's just the frequencies back from genetic back migration or what or admixture, I don't think we know. But in our cohorts, we found that 2DS1 frequency was low, and it was the same frequency in preeclamptics and controls. So it isn't 2DS1 that's protective. And so most women, therefore, don't have a telomeric B region in Africa. So there's something on this centromeric B that was protective. And this is, I think, the interesting thing about this cohort, really, is that there are a lot of variation in this centromeric B region, huge amount of variation. But to simplify it, we can just divide them into those that have a very sort of short centromeric B, and those that have a full-length one. And this full-length one is characterized by having this gene, 2DS5, and 2DL1, but 2DL1 on the B haplotype, so they are actually different, slightly different. And I should say that 2DS5, for those of you who know about here, of course, is normally on the telomeric B region in Europeans. It's normally over here. So it's actually in a different place, even, in African Ugandans here. And so we looked at this, and this is the one that is protective. So here is the absence. If you don't have, this is basically AA, so it's basically showing the same thing. If you have 2DS5 on the centromeric region, that is protective. And this is really showing the low frequency of telomeric B genes here, 2DS5 on other end. It can be on the other end in Africans. And these are other rare contracted or expanded haplotypes, which actually are much commoner, again, in this cohort than they are in Europeans. So what I think the message is here, that there is a completely different protective effect in this population. And this is a heat map, again, of this region, of this centromeric haplotype with this 2DS5 on it. And again, you see it is really an African haplotype. And as soon as you move out to other parts of the world, it's really not there. So now, how is it working? And I don't know whether nobody knows if 2DS5 binds anything, really. I don't think. Dan, do you know? I don't think we know. I don't think we really know much about its expression at all. And so it could be that. It could be that there's the effect of 2DL1, those B haplotype 2DL1 genes are important. So that is a question for the future. So if I can summarize really where we're thinking now, we've got these two groups of C alleles, C1 and C2, here. And we know this is a very weak inhibitory interaction here with these two inhibitory here, whereas C2 has a really strong and specific interaction, inhibitory interaction, with 2DL1. And that this can be balanced in Europeans by 2DS1. So that's how you would balance this really strong interaction. But it's been puzzling me why this whole system just only works off C2. And if you have a C1 homozygous baby, it doesn't matter what the mother's care is. And that is something quite counterintuitive, because really this isn't, in traditional terms, allo recognition. You can have an allo C1 and it doesn't matter. It's only if you have C2 that it matters. And I think that maybe one can redraw it now, and because we know from a lot of groups that actually these inhibitory here don't just bind C1, but they're actually very promiscuous, and they're binding a lot of C2 as well. So really they're just kind of there in all pregnancies in a way, and it doesn't matter so much what on earth the baby has. It's this interaction which is very strong and very strongly inhibitory. And I think that probably that is a bit like malaria. There's a lot of hemoglobin ways of avoiding malaria, a lot of hemoglobinopathies. There's a lot of ways of not being AA, probably. And it's such an important thing for pregnancy not to be AA that probably it's worked out different ways of doing it. So we might say that this actually is very weakly inhibitory, these 2DL1 alleles on the B haplotype. It could be that. It could be this in Europeans. And now I think we just do have to consider whether this really very unusual haplotype in Africans, this 2DS5, with 2DS5 on it, isn't actually 2DS5 doing something itself, and it isn't just being carried by 2DL1. So in a way, I think it's to think of it, AA is very bad, but you can be not AA in a number of ways, is really the simple message. Now, I've really talked about these conditions of failed placentation, preeclampsia, recurrent miscarriage, fetal growth restriction. But I just want a final three slides, of talk about Dan's question he keeps asking. What's the balancing selection for this? And I think Richard's already given you a hint that birth weight is clearly the balancing selection. Because if you get too big, this is what happens. The baby gets stuck in the pelvic inlet here. And this, again, is much commoner in Africans. And actually, measurements of the... can you believe it? When I was a medical student, we used to go and x-ray everybody's pelvises and measure the pelvic inlet and to say... whether they were going to get, do you remember, Crispies, whether they would get obstructed labour or not. And, of course, it wasn't predictive in individual cases, but it's given us the data to see that actually this important measurement here across the pelvic inlet is about a centimetre smaller in women of African ancestry here. And this encapsulation of the obstetric dilemma, it's not just if you're very small and you have failed placentation, it's a very bad thing. It's very, very bad to be too big and to get stuck, and that both the women and the babies will die there. And it has been estimated that by anthropologists who've lived in situations where there is no access to caesarean section, that as many as 15% of births will result in either maternal or fetal death. Well, this is a huge selective pressure, clearly. And this, of course, is only a feature of humans because of bipedalism and the big head. So it's only a feature. So this may be, this last slide is maybe why we see this big change in both the Kier complexity of the Kier genes, this distinction between A and B haplotypes. We only see C2 in the great apes. It's not present in any other orangutans or any other lower primates. And this may all be really associated with this unique features of being human, that the pelvis is now very small relative to this very large brain. And so there are a lot of people who've helped. I just want to say that Sue Hebe, of course, has driven all these genetics. And I'm, again, sorry she's not here. But Alamp has done a huge amount of this genetics. So Andrew did all this functional thing with Shushu and Pippa. And, of course, I've had a lot of help from John, where John is, as well. But also Paul Norman has done this allele typing for us now, this 2DS5, to help us, and all these colleagues in Africa. And Richard, who has been looking at birth weight with us as well. Thank you.